what you feel is different between the attitudes of the white kids, or the white youth, and the white adult. And how do you, well, yeah.
Well, I think in today's generation, I think the white adults, like we were talking about yesterday, I think the adults right now have been influencing their children to hate. And I think that the youth of today, I think they've been doing a remarkable job compared to yesterday's generation. Because I've noticed that even in this camp, and even in our group, that the togetherness that we've had, and that the love that we also received, and like the incident we had, it seemed like many people, like I guess it's just today's generation, you know, that it seems like they really tried to omit the hatred against the Negro.
Are you pretty optimistic about the chances of our generation growing up? And
I think it's going to get worse.
Get worse?
Yes, I think so. Because I hate to say it, but because of the white youth who's been really trying to do their best to omit the hatred, I honestly feel now, I think it is the colored people's turn now to have their hatred against the white. I feel that.
You feel it's rightly or wrong?
For the hatred?
Yeah.
Of course I feel it's wrong, because it's wrong to hate.
You feel it's going to be the youth or the adults? I mean, the black, yeah, the
youth.
Black adults? The youth.
Youth.
Hmm?
What do you think is going to happen for?
Well, I know there's not going to be any peace until the world's cleaned up.
Of what?
The world's cleaned up. Probably there's going to be a lot of riots, a lot of destruction, failures, hatred, of course. And because of these white people, because they're trying their best right now to try and love the colored person, because of the black person now, he's going to turn the hatred that might change the white person's mind again back to what they used, that they previously thought. And again, they might have hatred, and again, we might have two races hating each other.
Who's been fighting these riots like in the last year?
Who says they're planned?
Can
we ask about the date? Yeah. Are they getting any
ideas for planning? See if they've got any more. Because all we know is that we
have
the
question is,
are the
riots
planned?
According
to the current report,
they were not.
No. Every one of them.
Riots are never planned.
A series of events.
You think they are planned, potentially?
Why not? Well, I'm just wondering who has been behind them in the different communities where they happened last year. Or is this maybe some. Or was this as a result of a demonstration, somebody take the initiative to go a step further?
Well, the riot in Minneapolis certainly wasn't planned.
No.
It happened when there was a parade downtown. It was kind of a hot night, and people got together, and from what I hear, I think some of the kids here were living out here to tell it better. But it just kind of grew. Little couple of people getting together in an alley somewhere saying, well, let's start something. Is that bigger and bigger?
Why did it happen? Why did the riot occur in that? What did happen? What was going on among the people who were rioting?
Yeah, a lot of griefs that weren't being filled. They had promises, but they weren't filled. And so they were getting mad, like there was supposed to be better housing, and there were plans to employ, and like before, they tried to, you know, employ people, they got them summer jobs, and and eventually they would lose these jobs, you know, over the winter. And so, like, they thought, like, every summer we'd get a job, and that was it. And they had a whole lot of complaints, but, you know, how do anybody pays attention to you when if you don't do something?
Yeah, but weren't most of the rioters kids?
Not really. They had influence, too, by the adults.
Yeah, but the adults sat on the side. If they were really interested, why weren't they helping during the day?
Kids did demonstrate. That's what
no,
happened.
No, the adults that sat on the side. Well, the kids did it.
So some of them.
Well, one thing that was in the paper was that the Negro kids did it, and really there was a lot of white kids there.
The white kids were riding too. Well, that's the case, you call it a racial riot. If that's true, was it a racial riot? Was racism the cause?
No,
there were a lot of things that white kids did that the Negroes got blamed for.
Yeah.
Was it more the have-nots against the haves, which is then?
If it was white people involved, it was probably the poor white people there.
They weren't real.
It was pretty much racial because any white person wasn't very welcome in that area at that time.
I think it basically it was not racial. I know of white and colored men who sat in cars together to protect their homes against white and colored kids who were coming out and destruction. All up and down one street, we had white and colored people together with guns ready to protect each other's homes against white and colored kids. But the basic problem, as I see it, is our news media. I've mentioned this before to most of our group, but many times white kids would be the ones who broke windows and came out and the colored kids didn't. And there are many, many incidents like this. Another thing that governor's office stated this ex officially to a group of clergymen that the major reason the National Guard was called out in Minneapolis was because we had a group of some 1,500 white people who were armed, who had set a time, who were coming in to kill the black people. The National Guard had to beat them to the draw. This was never publicized, never in the newspaper, but this was the major, now not the only, but the major reason.
I have no background to disagree, but I disagree with that.
Go ahead and disagree. The state representative and the man from the governor's office were there.
I cannot say that there's that much hate black man. It's a fine hole. 2,500 guys that he could have come down and just shoot him in cold blood.
I can be prejudiced for being honest here, but I cannot just stand up and shoot him right now.
Or even while he's burning Plymouth Avenue.
We're not equal in your eyes. Look who frees the Negroes.
But I was just saying,
what show of love has there been? But look who freed the Negroes. The Negroes should be free in the first place. I mean, look who freed them.
What's the issue?
What you're talking about, from what I heard from Tom, 2,500 Negroes that were, 2,500 whites that were going to come down to the Negroes last year. But just before you know any further, to add to that, Tom said, I don't feel that 2,500 people could go down, no matter what they say,
with a group. I don't believe that maybe more than 50 in that group would actually do it when it came right down to it.
50 or less?
I think they'd know.
They just go, they just...
They go along, they go along. They say they shoot, but they get there. No matter how many guys...
Why is there Ku Klux Klansmen?
I'd say you couldn't... Okay, how many Ku Klux Klansmen are there the whole United States?
They can have memberships through mail.
Already, but they're still aren't...
Yeah, so still, they don't want hot dogs on a strike in the future, are they?
They have already.
And what is, and if there was 2,500...
How long they walk down the streets and chat white?
If 2,500 men were coming down armed to the Chief National, what were the...
They'd shoot everybody.
They would have fired 50 National Guardsmen.
They're gonna come down and chew it up anyhow. If I had 2,500 guys behind me, 50 National Guardsmen wouldn't stop me.
No, it's basically they shouldn't have...
If I was that much, if there was that much hatred...
It isn't the point if they're gonna do it or not, it's what they're thinking about.
Let's take it off the 2,500 and put it on this. I say that the basic cause is white prejudice is behind it all.
I say that the cause is not enough people here that don't know the problem.
There are lots of white people in the United States, whether there were 2,500 in Minneapolis relative to 94. There are lots of white people who respond to the statements of Ralph Brown, Sylvia Carmichael, people who say there's going to be a hot summer in the cities this year. There are lots of white people who respond, well, it's about time that white people get armed and preserve law and order. There are certainly lots of white people who, whether or not they would have the courage to go through with it, or whether they have the arms or not, feel perfectly justified in responding to any rioting with a very strong show of force. What about this? Well, what does this mean? Is this justified?
I went to school in Minneapolis, my roommate worked with a white fellow in a factory who lived in North Minneapolis. And he said that he had 300,000 rounds of ammunition in his house in case there was another riot there. Take it or leave it, 300,000 rounds is not a lot. But he admitted that there was other people who had 10, 20, 30,000 rounds.
That's right. Listen.
Just wait. And I talked to another fellow that I worked with, John. I won't mention his name. His dad's an older man. But he also said that in his house, they were prepared to with a few guns and a few ammunition in case it ever came hot. They ran into trouble last year, and they weren't going to run into trouble with them this year.
Yeah, no, we know.
Why would they be so afraid then? I'll tell you, I know a person that lives in Minnetonka, and it's really ridiculous what he's gone through. He bought 2 pistols this year. And, here it is. But, look at the reason of killing Negroes. And for years they'd lived in this house, they'd never locked the door, so they're going on history in Minnetonka. And now, he locks the door all the time because he's afraid that the bus he's plugging his mouth there and he's at the home. And this is
the show that he's done. Getting back to this last story, if anybody's going to tear down my house, I don't care if he's black, white, any color at all. I'm going to protect my home.
That goes to my house too.
Yeah, right.
Any house.
I'm going to protect it. It's mine.
And if you take it up, these colored people are the people that are causing trouble, or even the good people. I mean, themselves, to make sure that their houses don't burn and their buildings don't burn.
Right, if the whites were rioting, put it this way, and the other whites, you know, the whites that did riot, you know, and let's say they burned their own stuff, you know, the whites burned our stuff, you know, everything. I bet that the whites would arm themselves again to protect themselves against the whites. It's not just because they're arming themselves, you know, against the blacks. It's just that they're protecting what is their own.
Yeah.
Well, do you think the solution is then for everybody to arm themselves more? Or
I'm not saying it's a solution, but
if it's true, as you say, that most of us would defend our homes against rioters of any sort, then what was wrong with Mayor Daley's statement that got him so much condemnation in the press among churchmen? Daley said that he'd given the police, I don't want to misquote him now, in a sense he'd given the police instruction to shoot rioters on sight. Now, whose fault is it?
And I believe it's Carmichael, but they say that the black people have been suffering under white domination for a long period of time, and that the white people owe the black people something, and that they want to get it now, and that they aren't going to get it by peace. They just want to get it if they deserve it, so they're going to take it.
I'm talking about the poor white people, and live under the conditions of the colored people.
I don't think we owe them anything.
Say what you said again and let somebody answer. Vivian.
We don't owe them anything.
Regardless if that is if that is correct, and that is a good point, if that is the way they're thinking, and that is the way they're feeling, we have to live by the way they're feeling, because they're the ones acting, and we have to act towards them to reconcile. If they feel we owe them something, then we better give it to them, or they're just going to come in and shoot us to take
it. That's the wrong attitude, too.
It may be wrong, but if that is their attitude, it is up to us to reach to them.
Black people are trying to take over the white people.
Who said they were?
He said the Germans are trying to take over. They're holding down. Well, when America has war with another country, they try and make up for what they done. They do. A lot of people have gotten hurt, that they help set up hospitals and help people. Renew the area and everything. We also set up a self-government and everything. So why can't America do it in their own country?
Well, I think they should.
Let me see if I can put your statement in another way. If it's true that in the past the Negroes have been denied jobs and all sorts of education, all sorts of opportunities, does it make any sense legally, politically, morally, for Negroes living now to say that they have a right to compensation for the injustices of the past by taking something from people who are living in the present? Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't think that's right. Why? It should be corrected the other way.
It's not being given soon enough.
However, it is our society, and so is it our society as a whole, that has to compensate them.
But you have to have an understanding of how they must feel. I mean, they've been suppressed for so long, they must, they're just about, they're to a bursting point. And you can't expect them just to say, oh, that's okay, and keep turning the other cheek. Because it's just not human, and they're not going to do it that way.
They're
Yeah.
You don't believe that they're gonna take what they have. One of my teachers talked with a black leader from North Minneapolis, and he said that for this summer, they have been laying a foundation for a riot in San Diego to go up this summer, and it's taken a period of 10 years. Now, it's the outsiders that have moved in to set up this riot in this area. They can, you know, leave it if you want to, or hurt if you don't want to. That's what's going on. What's it going to lead to? They are going to take what they think they deserve. Now, are we just going to stand by and shoot them down and have a agreement as we view them, referencing the history, have a revolution such as in France? These are things that are going back and forth again. The nation is up in arms, and what's in that nation? Or are we going to compensate them for the sake of order and peace, even though it may not be the right position?
What does this thing carry in the way? As long as you didn't burn it down. Mm-hmm. This is another compound itself, you see, so right there.
What's the problem? The orders go out to be a topic that if they. No, well, he can't say that's true, but this is what we heard, that if there's another riot in Minneapolis, that the people are going to come through Edina and go up to Minnetonka and bring them home to the Bureau of Health.
About time.
Nobody tries to get aware.
I don't think we're really concerned about the colored people too, who are vastly outnumbered and are scared stiff that the white people are coming in to get them. And I've mentioned this too before, that the night after, or the weekend after Kane's murder, immediately we had white cars coming up and down our streets with guns out the window, white guys with guns out the windows carrying signs, "I'm going to get me a nigger tonight." And they were shooting through the homes of people, they were shooting at colored people, they were shooting through colored churches, and trying to stir up trouble immediately.
And maybe that's just one example.
That is one example, but people in Minnetonka have, they think they're afraid. You ought to think what it'd be like to be the minority.
But so if that's a riot, it's not a white man on the side.
What? What was that?
I said if there's a riot, it's not a white man on the side.
Sir, what?
The riot.
If there's a riot, now the white man's on the side.
Yeah,
but
that's
right, because the color
black now comes out as a riot, the white man starts a riot. Is that what you're trying to say?
Come in, I'm all these guys coming in, shooting all these boys down. So what, we're supposed to stand around and get shot too?
Yeah, the 26 major riots last summer, 50% of them were started by the police.
That's true. The great feeling was down in the courthouse. The night of Martin Luther King's assassination was quite interesting, actually. The police chief walked in and said, "Well, that's one less for next summer." And these guys, these bigoted people down at the courthouse, they're in Minneapolis. I mean, they can hardly wait until summer comes on. Maybe they'll get deputized. They can tell themselves a black person. This is the city government,
Janitors in the courthouse.
Oh, janitors in the courthouse. Well, they deputize them in the summer now. I mean, they're deputies.
They go out and show with broomsticks.
I don't think you're facing this realistically at all. I mean,
that's right. You won't face it.
Take another example. What about the four cops from Golden Valley that were picked up by the colored and the colored accused them of causing trouble or whatever they were doing. Now, who started that? They were in the neighborhood, and what were they doing? Taking a joyride just to see the sight.
They were causing a Negro woman is what they were doing.
There's the Board of Jury. They talk to the police.
Come on,
you might also be right. You might want to change the clock. The start of the department might start the riot.
There was the detention.
Well, look, does anyone feel that anything is to be accomplished or has been accomplished by the riots in our cities in recent summers?
More fear.
More friction and hatred, she says. What do you say?
The white man on the road got tired of talking.
Yeah, I think it kind of made the white people wake up and really see what's happening. Before, nobody cared to, nobody would listen to their problems.
They're waking up, and it doesn't seem like anything's happening, so.
Here's a question.
Maybe not where you live, but I think in the city it has.
Go ahead, way back.
I don't think it helped at all because now part of the white people are, you know, afraid of other people now. And so they just, you know, give them jobs. They don't check them out or anything. They're not really equal. They're just, they're people don't want cities, you know, they don't want to just give me that job.
There's a question of fact has come up. Have the riots accomplished anything positive? Two of you said they got people to listen.
They did more than that. I have a sociology professor over at the university that he commented to discuss the Detroit riots. And he said that practically riots are the greatest thing that's happened for the Negroes. They have the places where the riots have started, the places that are being burnt down are your ghettos, are your slum areas, and they're destroying what they've had to live in. And when American society first built these cities, and then once they ran down and they left them and moved out to the suburbs, it was the Negroes and lower class people that came in and took their places. And finally, these places are being destroyed, and this is the first time that the Negroes and the lower class people have had a say in the rebuilding of their cities. They actually now will have a say in what is being built. And he commented that this is really a good thing, and that I guess there was at that time plans on burning down New Orleans, and he said, well, I hope it happens, because then we'll be able to have the problems down there, and they will have a chance to correct these things. That the only way you will be able to correct the material things are just by a total destruction, not just patching things up here and there. It needs a complete overdone, like last night, some people were discussing things, and they sit back and they say, well, we'll wait for 100 years or so, and maybe things will improve by then, and by this time, the racial problems in the United States go along with Karl Marx's theory of classes. He sees classes in the oppressed and the oppressors. And that once people who are oppressed become aware of their condition, they become a manifested group, and they will move out. And it has usually held up that his theory doesn't hold in the United States because class lines are not that clear cut. But in between races, they have become that clear cut. And growing awareness of this has made it into a manifested class, and this will move out the total revolutionary warfare. And that only through if the white society is not going to say give of their money and of their time, not just a 10% surcharge, but a drastic amount of money. But it will never be corrected by this pastor. Things have to be rebuilt completely and coming down as part of the process. Whether it's going to be voluntarily or whether it's going to be pushed upon us. And that is, and life in their own way have forced it upon us to accept it. And he said some other things. He's giving us
some statistics, he said that within the past 10 years, the suburbs in the United States have become more segregated. And that, and then he said that there was a lot of complaints on the National Guard was criticized in their handling of the Detroit riots. And they had a federal troops come in. There was a federal troops that were sent around the middle-class white area to protect their property from damage. Well, the National Guard was sent in to hear that a riot was actually being done, and they had to handle the problem in there while federal troops were sent to protect the rich white. And...
So what about this class war? Do you think it's true that Negroes, he was saying that Negroes and whites were rioting, and that we will get a real class war along racial lines?
He didn't say that. That's my name. They finished getting read a few articles on Marxist theory, and that I read that it does not hold true in the United States because your mass production makes things you cannot tell just by sight what class someone is on, but your mass production. And they gave that class line don't that clear anymore. But in the racial area, they are clear, just the color of the skin as well. And they had a chart on...
This is precisely the question I want to raise. Is it true that class lines are hardening along racial lines? In this country. You have to face the fact that there are more opportunities than ever before for at least a certain number of Negroes to go pretty high up in socioeconomic class. There are a lot of corporations today, just in the last 5 years, doing a very active program of recruiting Negroes for management positions. You look at television programs and you see in the chorus line a number of black faces. These people are, in socioeconomic sense, no longer members of the proletariat. What is their stake of revolution? Do they have it? With whom will they identify in the class war? You know what Stokely Carmichael called these people, the sellouts. He said they're the color. They're the white niggers. That term Uncle Tom changed its meaning very radically. One time Uncle Tom meant somebody who was very subservient and bob and freckled and was willing to keep his place in order to get the man out of his wife. Today, Uncle Tom is used by the militant flag, means somebody who actually succeeds in doing those things which for decades the Negro was looking for. He moves on up into the white power structure. What is this fact?
Most people have attached to the colored person. They are not considered themselves colored. They do not carry with them the feeling. And
marry white people.
They have law. You don't think of them as another colored person. You kind of set them off as an exception to the case. And that they were interviewing graduates at this one colored college and asking them on the benefits and the probabilities of them getting jobs with higher corporations. And some of them expressed the feeling that they were just doing this as just so they could sit back and then take people into their classes and say, see, we employ colored patients too, aren't we unprejudiced, aren't we wonderful? And that they express the fear that they don't want things to be done to them just because of their color, but because they are a person.
Well, corporations, they can't get any contracts with the government unless they have a certain percentage of Negro employees.
Well, I work at a bank, and they have little in the back. Well, I work in the back in the department, not in the back, you know, the transit department, and they have this thing right over where you punch out. It says if you feel you are discriminated against and all the things you should do. And they hire all different types of people. They have Negroes and Filipinos and Puerto Ricans and everything, like, you know, all the different things. And at first I thought this was really something. And then I started to notice that there's not a Negro teller or Puerto Rican teller or Filipino teller. That all the tellers are white Caucasian people. And I think that, you know, they give the Negroes a job, but the transit department is about as low as you go in a bank. And that's where the Negroes are working.
And you can tell a lot of stories like this. You can tell a lot of individual stories like this, but there are data on what they have brought a picture. And while what you say is true in many similar instances, there are lots of instances too where the Negroes are tellers. Now, I think we want to be aware of being an isolated instance. He brought up the question of potential class conflict. I was trying to get out several facts and see how we put them all together. One of them is that there are a lot of people who are preaching conflict, class conflict. They're saying there's got to be a fight, a struggle, the so-called black militants. These are people who are sort of, well, Leroy Jones would be a good example. A man who, my wife around me?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Here.
Just briefly describe what Leroy Jones did.
Well, he's gone through a distant connection with Roth, because, well, I think Roth had, in some ways, a very positive effect, because I think they in the black community.
Well, listen, baby, don't give us me to tell what Leroy Jones.
Well, now this is what he says. Now, Leroy Jones, in the rise of Leroy Jones, the writer, for those of you who don't know, the word playwright and so on and so on, he kind of dropped out of that about 3 years ago and began working full time in organization where he was working with very militant groups in Harlem. And in a Newark riot, he was arrested because he was wandering through Newark in the midst of the riot 2 summers ago with a gun and so forth. Last summer, and he's been up through the court. Now, he goes out, he went out all last year preaching, violent revolution, burn the city, and so forth and so on. And it scared an awful lot of white people and the press papers. Now, after King's funeral, or after King was shot, before the funeral, things were getting hot again in Newark as they were in many other cities. And Leroy Jones was walking through the streets of Newark with the guy from the Black Revolutionary Party in Harlem, and I forget his name, but he's another man who has been advocating a violent revolution. And both of them were cooling things in Newark. And the reason for this was not particularly out of respect for King, because Jones frequently said he didn't care much for him. But Jones said that he felt that the riots were tried because violence was a live alternative and had to be tried. You get hit and you try fighting back. Nothing else would work. But he wasn't satisfied with what had happened with the riots. They simply destroyed parts of their city. And he had changed his mind and now felt that political power was the only real answer to for the black man, and that's what black power is all about. And he said, now in Newark, you know, 50% of us are black, and we're going to have a mayor here, and that's the way we're going to have power. And Ron Karenga in California is talking the same way, and Carmichael in his book with Hamilton said a lot of the same kinds of things. And some of these men, very, very militant people, have gone beyond that violence and have seen political power.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to get into the sort of happy ending.
It's not a happy ending. I'm just saying that Jones has shifted his position.
Yeah, well, I went into one of the earlier. The point I really want to make in introducing Jones was that here was a man who was in the power structure, a wealthy man.
No, all right.
He teaches
at the new school.
Right, he was a well-off man, and he gave this up. he came back and joined the blacks. He reduced to become bourgeois. Similarly with Carmichael and Karenga and a lot of other people who have identified with blackness, who, you know, because they're black is beautiful. They refuse to go on up into the white power structure because they think there's a battle that has to be fought, and to accept some of the things for which the Negro was long fighting is to sell out. But that's one group of people. On the other hand, you have Negroes who are perfectly willing. I mean, who can blame them? When they get a job with a corporation, they take it. When they get a chance to buy a nice, beautiful home, they go live in it. They take the good economic things that come with success in the American system. Dick, I wonder how your family would line up if it turned out to be a fight between the haves and the have-nots. Would you line up with the haves and the have-nots? Would you give up your place out there, Northeast Minnesota, Minneapolis?
I don't know if they are, but I think I will maybe move away from Northeast. Myself, I would like just like to live in a mixed neighborhood. Everybody, Indians, Japanese, whites, Negroes, everybody. That's the kind of neighborhood I would like to live in. Myself, my family, if we came to that point, we'd like, I don't know what they would do.
This is Christian. Mm-hmm. You've got to turn the other cheek. I mean, if all of a sudden we decided that we were going to give the Negro an even break, and you know, like this is pretty idealistic, but if all of a sudden we were going to treat him like another white person, you know, I don't think he'd turn the other cheek. I think he'd want to get back and make it, you know, take advantage of their sudden turn of events. So don't you agree, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if all of a sudden we decide to let bygones be bygones and start treating you like an equal, would you feel right?
Oh, yeah.
Would you? Are you a Christian?
What are you saying again?
I'm not listening.
No, I'm just saying that if all of a sudden we, you know, we started accepting it, white, you know, like we wouldn't stare at you when you came to our high school, and we wouldn't throw you out of restaurants.
So is that ever going to stop?
Well, I'm just saying this is idealistic. I know it'll take time, but see, we got to work through new generations, and this is why, this is what this camp is for. It's Christian. The only way you're going to stop this is by the teaching of Jesus Christ. Love your neighbor, no matter what his color.
Well, that was preached way back there, and it hasn't been fulfilled yet.
Right. People just haven't listened. I got to start sometime. If you're going to say, well, let it go to the next generation, then it's just going to keep on going and going and going.
What does Christianity have to do with
religion? We treat them like
kids. Everything.
I'd like to argue that it has nothing to do. We're talking about a political problem, the relationship between groups of people. We're talking about with Christian. I'm playing devil's advocate. I think there's some truth to what I'm saying. I think they start talking about people have to have love in their hearts and accept the teachings of Jesus Christ. What's that got to do with conflict, socioeconomic, political, racial conflict between groups of people?
I agree with you. You say your argument. You might be arguing with the rest of them, but not arguing. I mean, I don't think when it comes right down to Christianity, you can have anything to do with it. The people are going to heed the heeding of Jesus. I think it comes out of what you said in the economical thing.
You cannot not sell groceries to a man if you love. Can you?
No. Nope.
And the teachings of Jesus Christ says love your brother, your neighbor, everybody, right? And you never say black and
be
unheard.
Right down to it.
Huh?
Who's gonna lose one sounds right down to it? I mean how
Jesus
many
what?
These teachings that you're talking about? They were fitting you how people come to our bound.
They're not Christian.
Yeah. Okay, so if you go to church and the man says, well, I
right.
Every time you do that.
Believe
the
it.
People are telling us
believe
it.
Yeah, well, it's going to take. You got to start somewhere. You got to start somewhere. I'm saying it's going to take time. It's going to take maybe a lot of lives, maybe a lot of prophecy. But don't you have to start somewhere?
Right, well,
I mean, don't you realize that this is
Christian idea? I don't think Christianity can do it.
Yeah.
You think Christianity is going to do it?
That's the whole key to the whole thing.
Christianity could do it if Christianity
would
put itself up to be the Christians.
If they're true Christians,
themselves.
If they're true Christians, they're not like them.
They go to church. They go to church and they say this, but it's not. They're not Christians.
Yeah, go ahead.
Are we trying to find out your about Christians, like, if an Eagle family, I think Hopkins or would you be prejudiced, or would you just leave them be, just normal as anybody else?
Would you repeat that again?
Just repeat that too loudly.
If two colored families moved into your neighborhood and you haven't, been exposed to colored people, would you treat them the same as you treat all the white people on your block?
Well, speaking of Minnetonka, I think for the most part, at least the attitude that I've seen, it might be changed, but I think the people would, for the most part, the people would accept that very heartily, I think. I think it'd be good for the area too, and I think they partially.
What I saw in the contract was that a Negro, well, he was an exchange student, so that makes a difference, but that for me, he was a Negro, and so everyone, all the kids just went able, and they just wanted to be his friend. And I mean, he was really a great guy and everything, but I think a lot of it was just because he did want to prove that I'm not prejudiced.
Well, Dick is a perfect example. Dick, do you yourself actually think that your personality is so much better than everybody else, that you can get along with everybody, that you can become the student council president of your class? Do you think that? That was the only reason? Yes.
We realize how far we've gotten since we started. You're talking about what will happen to a Negro who moves out of the Minnetonka. Well, a Negro who moves out of the Minnetonka is going to be a half. Like, I don't know where Minnetonka is, but I take it. It takes money to move out of there.
No.
Well, all right. But a Negro who moves out into the suburbs is somebody who already has. We started talking about the problems of the haves and the have-nots. There's a different problem. Certainly, it's a problem. A Negro who's got a good job, professional man, and tries to move into an all-white neighborhood, there's a problem. There are many people who are going to welcome him, and many are going to reject him. But whatever happens to him, this does nothing for the people who are trapped in the central city. The people, mostly black, some white, who don't have the means to participate in the American dream. What about these people? What's going to happen? What are we going to do about it? I thought this is what we were interested in talking about. We got into race because someone decided that the problem was in large part racial. But I, for one, am still concerned about the haves and the have-nots in our society, the growing conflict between them.
Economically, don't they have to be that way? There has to be a have-not in our society.
If we didn't pay so many taxes into the government for a war, people could be, they could ride in a good car and have a nice home and everything. We spend so much for war and for other things, and like going to the moon, we would have everything that we wanted almost.
So do we. Yeah, but then, Sharon, then you're going to have to spend money, if you don't give it to the government to supply wars over someplace else, then you're going to have to give money to the government to stop them from coming into the United States.
Here we go. I don't think the whole answer is just end the war or something, and then all of a sudden the money that would be going into the war and the race in space would solve the problem.
But don't you think it would help?
Well, sure, it would help. But I'm not saying it's going to end it.
That would give the rich more money too, wouldn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the rich would get richer, and the poor would get richer.
If the government you know, if you still paid taxes to the government wouldn't have to give to the war, it could give to poverty.
And relief.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But they could cut
relief. Well, they're spending a lot. They're spending a lot. Yeah, they're spending a lot.
What the purpose of talking about this anyway? Yeah. War.
What do you got? Don't hold up your hand.
Well, we're getting away from the question again. What would the people do in Minnetonka?
Yeah, first of all.
They just put it off like most of the people would, you know, accept them. But what about the others that wouldn't?
I like to, first of all, what I said about everybody accepting them, I thought about that. I think I'm thinking more of my school. I'm thinking of the kids, and I think they'd accept it. Whether, I mean, I know the guy she's talking about, Jackie's talking about the AFS kids, but I still think the kids are accepted. But I think just having, well, I wouldn't say one Negro family, it might be tough on them. I don't know who, I can't put my finger on who would be putting pressure on them, but it would be tough for them to make it. And by the things I've been, I don't think that you can put in a lot of Negro families either. You throw them all over, so there's more than just one. Because then, right away, everybody, people are going to worry. There are a lot of people out there, I guess, that aren't going to worry that it's about it being integrated, and that'll bother us too. So I can't offer an answer or give any answer about the what the attitude would be out there.
Are you turning towards Christianity then? For the answer?
No.
Don't you think that's him?
Yeah.
I live in a suburb of St. Paul, and there was a Negro family who was planning on moving into our community where there is no Negroes at all. And they were going to buy a house. And the people, you know, they all said, well, we're not prejudiced, you know. But yet you could feel the hostility in them. And this is why the Negroes, they kind of sensed it, you know, the way the owner of this house talked to them and everything. And so they thought, well, rather than fight this, you know, fight all this, we'll just move someplace else. And they did. We didn't get that Negro family there. And so people can say, you know, well, we're not prejudiced. And yet, they, you know, they felt this, the Negroes could feel this hostility in us.
A lot of people in the suburbs, I think it's true that they fear Negroes moving in. And I think the reason is because they have so many financial interests. For instance, they own property and they don't want to make big losses on property. So they don't want to have a lot of Negroes because, you know, we had an argument about this last night. And I heard that it's a myth that property values go down when Negroes move in. But whether or not it's a myth, white people fear that they'll own a home and Negroes will begin to move in and so that the property values will go down. A lot of people in the suburbs, you know, their money is what they have. And that's their interest.
A lot of times the value of the property goes up when a Negro wants to buy it because when we bought our house, that's what happened. Like realty companies tell the white people that, you know, there's something, you know, something that happened, like a riot or something, houses are all burnt or something, and they have to move somewhere. So they're probably going to come in the white area. And those houses, prices go up, and those realty companies have to make a profit, you know. I said, well, we can probably jack the price of your house up a few hundred or something. They do this.
I'd like to get an answer on this one. A colored family does move into a white neighborhood. The property values go down, you know, they go down, I know. Do they come back up again? Or do they stay down?
According to the Ford Foundation, we take a survey on this, and it says 4-1 they will go up.
Well, that's because...
Who will buy the houses?
Yeah, because they sell them to Negroes.
Well, don't
and they'll take advantage of it.
Yeah. Because of all the people moving out? Because yeah.
But they go up again.
But they tend to go up again and go up even further because even more people can do. What typically happens in an area in transition is that a panic occurs, and then a lot of people want to sell. The supply exceeds the demand, the price is full. But then the area is open to Negroes, and in most areas, this isn't always true, in most areas, the demand for housing of this type by Negroes is much greater than the available supply. The price is immediately rising but much higher. So that a smart white person would sit there and wait and be the last person to sell, and he would make a killing. So that generally speaking, it's true that a white person who loses his property values because of integration has done it because of panic. Well, there are exceptions, and it depends upon patterns of housing, availability of housing, and housing in particular areas.
Just bring up the question, and once the block or the neighborhood becomes all colored, does the property value still stay at its peak, or is it going to go down now?
No, it probably remains higher, simply because of the shortage of housing for neighborhoods in most parts of the city.
Minneapolis is nothing compared to Chicago, where I come from.
Really?
And the ghetto in Chicago is increasing 6 blocks every week. And at that rate, within 10 years, Chicago will be a black city with complete white suburbs. And when the whole city is black, there will be no way possible to get any of them out, except by moving them to another big city.
I want to raise once again the question. Yeah. If everybody in this country were to turn sort of an even olive drab overnight, would the problem of the inner city disappear? Would it change at all? No. What is the problem?
What do you mean drab?
There would be new problems.
Before we get off on the question, I thought all these Jackson kids, Middle Township,
I make a motion we move over to the lift. The conversation seems to be a lot hotter there than it is here.
Yeah,
that's
all
that we
have in this. So how many are you thinking now? Three? Four?
Let me ask you this. I think that I've been listening here, and I can hear this next generation and this generation. I don't have a move for this. Are you kids or those others and the problem? Because eventually you're going to be a problem, you know, and then it's going to be plenty out of your feet, it's going to be concerned about, it's going to be you that's going to be hiring some businesses, it's going to be your money that's invested, it's going to be your interest. Right now you're scot-free, you can have the ideal to have it clear up 3 years, but you have nothing invested.
Do you agree that your generation has failed?
I think our generation is staying like the one that preceded us and probably like the one that followed us and the one that followed me.
Well,
thanks.
You have a question, you didn't have to know.
I think the problem, I don't think that.
Let's be further. Keep that question alive. We'll come back to it in a moment. Huh? What is new in science? That is there new in science? Maybe Carol's not here.
I was done very much at the excellent growing discoveries in science. A real and direct cause for the social turmoil that is around. I would think that if you're going to point to any scientific things, people call upon probably the relativity of Einstein and Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle, which people probably misuse. I don't understand it, but from what I've been able to gather anyway, he was kind of jumped to great conclusions just by the name of it. The idea of not being able to pinpoint some of the small particles that matter, leaping to large views of social or everything else. And I would think the social awareness of students has got something to do with it in terms of maybe even kind of frustration at some place to go. Where are you going?
If the standards are breaking down in science, if scientists have no sure standards anymore, then how can there be standards?
I really wonder if there's reason that way consciously. I think it's more the inability to meet directly social kinds of problems that they feel more or less involved in.
Okay. So,
John Cage, who's one of you may know about, is an avant-garde musician in his music. If you listen to it, it was a very intense, very disorganized and fragmented and broken up and very tense. And doesn't have the conventions that we're used to in, say, Bach chorale. It just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. It says that he, as a composer, has been very much influenced by some of the advances in modern physics, specifically the inability of scientists to, one, be able to predict the movement of certain subatomic particles, but two, the more fantastic view of that technology reports, but not to that which I want to understand, that in observing the movement of certain subatomic particles, the act of the scientist as observer makes a difference. And that we can't be objective observers of the most fundamental facts in modern physics. And somehow our act of observing changes what we're observing. And this puts a, you know, fantastic burden on man, and also destroys the whole idea of an inherent order in the universe and in people. This has been reflected now in music, as I said, with John Cage, and he is music. And, reflected, I think, in the theater of the absurd, and it's been reflected in the anti-novel, and in a lot of other ways. And probably these kind of staggering discoveries would seem to be many people undermining the whole idea of an orderly universe and being reflected in the new literature and music by time play a very significant role in the kind of protest we see now. But the protest we see now isn't specifically directed against a certain professor, but it's kind of polydirectional. It's going in many ways. It's more like what Camus would have invested in his metaphysical reflection, and you can't stand the way things are altogether, and you're just rebelling. You're just satisfied with the way the universe is, and you want to do something like that. It seems to me this is a feeling which probably characterizes the thought of the different things that you see in the music. You know, many science would see that in one sense it's precursor to it.
McLuhan, by the way, like quote John and Kate. Okay. What were you
doing? I was just going to say one thing. I think college students, at least I have think about a lot of science is expanding so fast that learning how to do so many things that you sort of start wondering, well, where will it end, and how can you just MRI? You know, I have been with a machine, you know, like psychologists who are learning to train the mind. And advances in that part of science, you know, these have an effect in it. You start wondering, like, where the drawing ends, you know, what important to us have as a human being.
Well, let me read you just a little bit from McLuhan. In the medium of the massage, he has page, the top of a picture of a whole bunch of women. They're apparently quilting, and they're lettering onto their quilt, "Keep in circulation the rumor that God is alive." And underneath it says, "The Newtonian God, the God who made a clock-like universe, wound it and withdrew, died a long time ago. This is what Nietzsche meant, and this is the God who is being observed." Anyone who is looking around for a simulated icon of the deity in Newtonian guise might well be disappointed. The phrase, "God is dead," applies aptly, correctly, validly to the Newtonian universe, which is dead. The ground rule of that universe, upon which so much of our Western world is built, has dissolved. I think the key phrase is, upon which so much of our Western world is built. I don't know to what extent students there are being influenced by the new physics, but I think it certainly is true that I think that our conceptions of the social system, the American political philosophy is heavily Lockean. And Locke and Newton have one worldview. Well, if the Newtonian worldview is dead, maybe the Lockean worldview is dead too. And we are all Lockean, far more than we realize. Are today Locke's conception not only of the political order, but also of the individual psychology. It's all breaking down. Nothing holds.
I'm just going to say that, too. It seems like what's happening is that the social scientists, well, they are scientists, and they're taking upon the scientific principles and with cybernetics and all these advances. They're trying to apply scientific principles to technology and theology that we're just interested in. It doesn't seem as though there's scientific principles have changed, but that we're just applying this to all of us. Or maybe I'm
yeah, very, very interestingly, there's a book that has been published recently by a man named Floyd Matson called The Broken Image that points out very well that the social scientists, in taking over the methods that the physical scientists describe, are taking over the obsolete methods of the physical scientists. The world view, for example, of a man like B.F. Skinner, the philosophy of scientific method that B.F. Skinner employs is a philosophy that began to die about 1910. And I think this has generally been true with the social scientists when they've borrowed the philosophy of physical science. They've borrowed something that was already getting obsolete. This attempt to treat man as a mechanical creature is Newtonian. And I think it's most interesting that there is so much Newtonian social science going on in the name of let's be avant-garde when those scientists who actually made successful use of these methods have abandoned them now as inadequate. So I would say that these social scientists are simply behind the times, and what they're doing is having very little impact. I certainly do not find that the people, well, I keep picking on B.F. Skinner, I'm sorry to do that here. I do not find college students today at all fascinated by B.F. Skinner.
Oh, but they are. They really are. They read Walter Tuchman.
They read it, but do they like it?
Oh, sure.
So I teach a class every year in which the students are freshmen where they have to read B.F. Skinner, and I can't find any students who like him. They think the guy's crazy.
There's something else, though, that I think is going on in the social sciences. I think the kids really
get
excited about
to
disagree with
them. Well, to disagree with
them.
The point is
they really get excited.
Well, I agree, they get excited, but they disagree.
Well, sure, but
I think it's
responsible for a whole new approach to human experience and psychology. Especially with the people that we can't feel about, that keep getting excited, there's a lot of people that are extremely depressed or brain damaged and kind of a lot of shaping in the people's behavior. There's one thing, though, that's going on in social sciences that we haven't missed yet, and I think really has the answer to this problem about student unrest and student revolution. And it's being put down in some sense, it might be connected with computer physics. But there's a new pop magazine in psychology called Psychology Today that just went out this last year, or over a year, that's trying to reach many, many different segments of society other than the social scientists. And maybe just a couple months ago, I had done a quite extensive piece of research finding out it was directed more at what they call the hippie culture. Who is it that becomes a hippie? But in the article, they also explain positive for things that would cause student unrest, the people who are protesting against Dr. Taylor, the ones that are anti-Vietnam War, from the university, all of these segments of society. And they found one very telling point, I think, that everybody who met these revolutions was identifying himself as a segment of society that was suffering because of injustice done to him. And most of the time, this injustice was being done in the home. These people mostly came from upper middle class families where the parents both were away from the home almost all the time. And the kid himself, I say kid, but a college student, many times a junior, senior in college, would feel, I'm so alone and I'm really nothing and nobody really cares about me. And that's the way it is with the Negro. And that's the way it is with the South Vietnamese who's being killed by the Americans. And that's the way it is with everybody else. And I am one of them. Nobody cares much about me, and I get kicked around and dirt, and I'm going to see that something's done about this. And they feel really alienated from society. Sometimes they're just a number. I am in this society, you know, everything's a machine all around. And like Martin Buber says, I just have high-end relationships all over the world, and all relationships at all. And I'm going to do something about it. And I'm the one that stands up and leads a group of students against the injustice of the world, because I'm one of these people that I think are a very animated group of students right now that kind of They rebel against everything in society because society is being nice to them.
There have always been these students, Jerry. Why only in the last 10 or 15 years has it issued in the student
I think there's two things to say about that. One is that there haven't, I don't think, been quite as many before. Now this society, partly because of mechanization, has made people much more a number, a part of the machine than a real person. You know, we don't have the pioneering spirit now when families go out and challenge the wilderness together and you're part of this group and you've got an out group of nature or something. But you right now you're kind of a nothing. Everything goes without you and you're maybe a caught in a machine and you work in a factory or something. Or otherwise you're at a university or a college where there are hundreds of people and nobody really knows you. The professor calls you by number maybe or something. And, you know, it's a real feeling of alienation that didn't happen before as much. And I think that the really two things I'm talking about in alienation is also the breakdown of an in-group, a family group. There are really so many, you know, everybody has to have a need to belong to an in-group. A lot of families used to provide that. But now there are a lot of families that are, well, there's an amazing statistic about families that just, you know, in the social legislation don't stick together through divorce and whatnot. But many, many more families where the parents are married and all, but the family itself isn't together because parents are going in two different directions and the kids are left alone. The mother's got a job over here, the father's got a job over here, and the kids are growing up and they feel we don't have really any group to belong to provide us our security. A very definite aspect of modern society that wasn't here 100 years ago, maybe it was 10 years ago, but it seems to be having a chilling effect on a lot of these foods, at least according to design.
I think the third factor involved in this is that my generation, first generation, has grown up completely in a fluid. From the time we were born, we haven't had to worry about where clothes are coming from or our next meal or something, so we've been able to expand into other horizons. And when you get to college, you can go out and do these things and not have to worry about where your suffering is coming from. Whereas maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, if you felt alienated, you still had to worry about where your suffering was going to come from, so you had to work or do something. Whereas now we're not worried about it. We know that we're going to get our stuff. And so we can go out and expand into it.
Why don't you, Mike, if you know you can get yourself, well, why don't you go out and drink beer and have fun? Why do you go out and protest?
Well, I think both things do happen, you know.
Okay, yeah, we certainly don't want the number of students who are protesting.
There are a small number of students, actually. And another thing I think of these students is they probably have been influenced by modern science because, anyway, the ones I know that really go out and do this are the brighter members of, you know, the more intelligent people I know, the wider range. They, even if say they are in social science or philosophy or English or something, they still know what some of the new advances in science are because they read. And so I think they have been influenced by it.
I would want to insist, though, that they think they understand what the new meant in science.
All right, but I say that they do. Anyway, they can at least tell you what they are.
I recall students, the same like I was made before, but this one was beautiful, what students said. that all, everything depends upon your point of view. Everything is relative. That has been definitely established by Einstein.
I'd like to ask a question, just as a follow-up of this. Are we getting here then, if this is true, is this the problem of the leader class? Is the student today, who is living in an affluent society, you say he's one of the better students, so maybe his studies will represent a real challenge to him in terms of occupying all his time, he's looking for something to do in the time that his leader to him. He's not faced with the responsibility of feeding himself, paying for his tuition.
No,
I'm sure that's not true. Is this one of the directions that they're going because of leisure time in this group?
Yes, well, I think it is, but I don't recall it as being a problem. I myself think it's good.
What good?
the protest. And I think it's good that our generation does have the interest to move in this direction. And all I was saying is that we can afford to be more idealistic, say, than your generation was, because we don't have to worry about our clothes and food are going to come. And so we can afford those three of being idealistic.
Except for after you join them and you're really get in and be a part of the movement, then you do have to start worrying about them. Because you no longer can get a job. Your parents fall funds. Then you have people go right on protest and right on, you know, I'm working for
take an example, University of Minnesota. You can just get so lost in the crowd, nobody knows whether you're in the protest movement or not. You know, so there's no problem getting a job.
Yeah, well, it's different than University of Iowa, which is where it's more and they know who you are. Some way, someone knows. And that's one of the questions they ask. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get a job. Mm-hmm. We have a problem about you in University of Iowa, the guy wearing beard. They automatically assume if you were a guy wearing a beard and you wanted a job in the library and belong to the movement, then you were bad news for the library. The guy was working on his MA in English, the one that caused the fire. He ended up getting a job and so did his beard. But it was a big fight because it was automatically assumed that
of course, our campuses in the Midwest really haven't gone as far as So I think it's hard for me to judge. I just found the Midwestern universities.
Why not?
It's pretty hard to organize something in January.
What would you protest? Maybe you have a comment you should protest.
No, that isn't true.
I did not answer that question at all.
900 British people alive would be just something to protest.
There's something I noticed though in the very conservative, is very conservative Midwestern atmosphere that we have a little more liberal. But I noticed that most campuses, at least with the time periods I have, they both have an active group. The SDS seems to be the focal point of activity. And the leaders and the militant members of SDS, all of them, I learned this quite accidentally the first 2 years I was at St. Louis through the counseling that I just did, were the really most alienated people in their own life. They really had very, very severe problems. Problems so severe that in many times they actually had to seek psychiatric rather than just, counseling help. Because I think this coincides with this article I told you about that the people who really are motivated most highly to actively protest, to make themselves known as protesters, very commonly have a very deep identification with an out-group that the whole world kind of kicks instead of help. It's very easy for them to identify with injustice that they feel the world really has to just really bad at them.
You raised a point here. You said you didn't look on this as a problem. I'd like to ask for your views on the Columbia situation. Has it created a problem? The university decided this was closed down because of the protest movement. To say nothing of the reasons for the protest, maybe did a very good job.
Well, I think
this created a problem there for a sizable group of students who weren't part of the movement.
Yes, well, I would agree that something that might call me a problem went too far. Like legal. But I think we have to remember somewhat on our mass media in the reporting of it. The University of Minnesota, the same week the protest was going on, David Conlon was there, who was a professor of Vietnamese history at Columbia. He was a former World War II newspaper correspondent. He worked for CBS before he became professor at Columbia. And he told us that with this protest in Colombia, the news media simply were not telling us the truth. He said, for one thing, he got the impression from Minneapolis papers that this was sort of a spontaneous takeover of administration by a group of students who were angry really about little petty things. And that all of a sudden, with no warning, they decided to take over Columbia. He says, for six years, the student government in Columbia had been warning the administration that if they went ahead with their plans to build this gymnasium in the park in Harlem, there was going to be trouble. And that for 6 years, the students had asked the administration to meet with them to discuss possible alternatives to this. And the administration just kept ignoring the students. And so the spring finally, it came to a head, and the students acted. And they had protested, they'd gone through the student government to, you know, pass resolutions and ask for meetings and that, and nothing ever happened. So this was their last final act of desperation to try to do something. And the real problem I saw in Columbia was that these students then, after they took their action, did not want to face up the responsibility of their actions. They wanted to have complete amnesty for doing this. And that, to me, is a problem. When somebody breaks the law and then refuses to take whatever consequences comes to them. I don't think that is a problem, the actual takeover. I don't see that as being a real big problem for our society.
Why should students feel that, or why should anyone feel that students should be punished for, acting courageously in the face of an intolerably despicable moral situation?
Well, I just think, though, for their choice to really be moral, since they, according to the law and according to
the Columbia University was breaking the law, and the city of New York was breaking the law.
What law, Carol?
Well, a public park was being taken over by a private organization for a public plea to an initiative to be done.
But it wasn't contrary to the law.
Well, according to...
the moral.
No, according to former Parks Commissioner Holden, he said it was contrary to city statutes.
But did the courts agree?
What?
Did the courts agree?
Well, as far as I know, that's incontrovertible.
The Law University of Columbia apparently doesn't agree because they had quite a forceful statement opposing the meetings signed by most of the law professors.
But the thing you're most opposed to, though, was them not taking the responsibility for their action, not facing up to their responsibility.
Also, I think they're opposed to the action itself, the way it was
I read the findings, but I agree about
a change through violence.
Yes, right.
Basic point. That someone felt that they had a right to do this.
Well, see, the violence came in their not accepting their arrest or accepting somebody coming to get the hospital. That's really where the violence came.
They also protested the right of the students from any group to bring about their position to be forced, because this was a move to be forced. I think if you Columbia Law University professor who signed the statement, I don't know how large group it represented, were strongly opposed to this.
Mm-hmm. But as I say, I think this was this was the last act of desperation, and I think they had good reasons to do this. Because as Harold says, you certainly have a park in a nice affluent neighborhood cannot be bought for a token fee by any private consumer. You know, because there it's making use for the kids, so you take a park in some poor neighborhood and figure, what's 1 acre? You know?
Can I suggest that we were talking about, I think this is much what we've said, is along the lines of the standard interpretation of what's happened today. I'd like to now propose an alternative explanation.
Students have always protested. But only recently have they systematically and openly broken the rule of the state or the university, the law, in the process of protesting. We used to break rules, you know, but we were sneaky about it, because what we do, we knew if we got caught, we'd come. But today, students openly break the rules. They flout the law. They say something like, they act courageously in the face of an intolerably despicable moral situation. We are justified breaking the law. You do not have to obey an unjust law. This, I think, is what's new. Now, why? A number of things all conspire together, and I think that Ortega y Gasset would aptly, has aptly called it the revolt of the masses. This is going to make some people very angry, I hope. First of all, there is today a different attitude toward law, which has been fostered largely by the civil rights movement. Let me come back to that point. Then, closer to what Ortega is saying, it's a very definite turning away from the traditions of democracy and liberalism, especially on the part of many customary supporters of these traditions. The democratic, the liberal democratic tradition is in real trouble. Some of its formerly most staunch supporters no longer are willing to defend it, no longer accept its fundamental premises. Certainly there's a decline in our society of respect for rationality, with a capital R. Rationality in the historic sense, the kind of thing that Plato was trying to encourage in the dialogue. In our society, to be rational means simply to adapt means appropriately to ends. But ends cannot be determined rationally. And anybody who talks about the rational determination of ends is being silly. There is no such thing as rational determination of ends. The things which you use to determine ends are data and emotion. We say ends are all matters of value judgment. Where do your value judgments come from? Well, your emotions and those data which have conditioned you through life. All of this could perhaps be summarized. We are witnessing a revolt of the mass man. When Ortega y Gasset talked about the mass man back in 1930, he was talking about a man who does not understand or appreciate the sources of his own life. He has no respect for history, no respect for the complexity of the historical process. He acts, therefore, like a spoiled child. Because he does not understand those forces which give him life, such as the penicillin, which prevented him from dying at the age of two, the economic machine, which permits him to live in affluence, the complicated decisions of statesmen and techniques of diplomacy, which preserve what order there is in our troubled world. Because he does not understand these things, he does not respect them. And he thinks that the proper way to behave when anything goes wrong is to throw a temper tantrum. The Ortega confronts the masked man with what he calls the excellent man. And the excellent man, the elite, is the man who is not content with the first thing that he finds in his head, but who always questions what he himself opposes. Who puts himself under discipline, who recognizes a responsibility always to what other people are saying, to the corrections which other people propose to what he is thinking and doing. He is a man who is simply never content with himself, and who makes extraordinary demands upon himself. This kind of man is Ortega, this spirit. This was the kind of man that used to be celebrated and nurtured in the university. In the university today, we are creating spoiled children. All this, I hope you see, kind of ties together. Decline of rationality,
drive spoiled mail. That would be disrespect for the position of liberal democracy. Octavian's coming phrase says, the masked man, when there's a shortage of bread, runs out and burns down the bakery. Does that make any kind of sense as an alternative explanation for what's happening in California?
I think another point you can make in the mask man, too, is one we made last year when we were talking the same thing, and Barton's going after the resentment for leisure, the refusal of privacy, which is part of this whole syndrome.
That Ortega talks about that, too. He says the masked man resents anyone who tries to claim privacy for himself. That kind of person is a snob. What are you doing over there in the corner by yourself? Come on out and dance with us. And that's why the unforgivable sin would be apathy. Individual who, and we have to distinguish between hippies and the new left. They are not the same. The hippie is not a masked man. Couldn't be called off. But you see, the new left resents the hippie. The hippie's over there growing his own tree. That's apathy. I didn't feel
could you maybe restate this in a campus situation about having the bakery there?
Let me give an example. At the University of Chicago some years ago, there was very, very much student dissatisfaction with the university, what they called university cooperation with the selective service system. And the university was providing the selective service system with information which would keep University of Chicago students out of the military. And that, said the university, is why they did it. The university neither approved nor disapproved of the selective service system, but there were certain rules which, if the university followed, it would keep its students out of the draft. Well, now, there were students who were unhappy with the fact that anybody had to go into the army. And so they tried to get the university to refuse to provide this information. And the university said, but if we don't provide this information, everybody goes into the army. And the student said, we don't care. You've got to protest the emphasis. You know, so they sat down in the administration building and tried to disrupt the university. Now, it does seem to me that this is burning down the bakeries because there's no bread. In an attempt to keep people out of the military, you're taking measures which, if they are successful, we'll get more people in. Of course, but what you're saying is, but if we do this successfully, we'll bust up the whole system and nobody will have to go.
Well, I think it makes the individuals who are involved confront the problem directly, and if they don't agree with the system that they came to follow through with their protests, you know, not going in the military, and therefore, yeah, maybe disrupt it. You know.
Yeah, but notice the technique of, if you call it the technique of persuasion, of propaganda, of publicity, it is more than that. This is not a technique which leaves people free to confront the facts and decide for themselves. It's a technique of coercion.
Yeah.
It is not, it has nothing to do, I don't think, with traditions of liberal democracy. In the democratic liberalism, you promote discussion. You do not try to bring discussion to a halt until you are agreed to it, as one person put it. The new left is not interested in, they're not interested in being listened to.